Baku, Ray Bradbury, Noam Chomsky, of course, the Martin Luther King Jr. collection, which is hours upon hours. The Malcolm X collection is in there. The entire Civil Rights Movement collection. There's the Native American collection.
Women's history.
Women's history, music.
John Coltrane, Bob Dylan. It just goes on and on and on. $200 pledge, it's a $5,000 or $10,000 value. If you get one of each of these USB jump drives, over 1,200 hours on one, 2,300 hours total for the Voices That Change the World and the Pacifica Radio Anthology USB drives. Call now, $200 for the pledge to get both of them.
It's an incredible deal, and we do not want you to miss it. So please give us a call right now at 516-620-3602. 516-620-3602.
And you pick up both of these USB drives, you'll have enough voices so that anywhere you travel this summer, you can take these drives with you and educate yourselves, your family, your friends, and people that you run across who are like-minded around the world.
And we have less than a minute to go. The number again, we need five more calls.
516-620-3602. 516-620-3602.
And if there's someone who can pledge at the $1,000 level or the $5,000 level, do it right now. Remember, it's a tax-deductible contribution, and you can get a few of these sets if you want and hand them out. Send them to places all around this country. Send them to high schools. Send them to colleges, universities, libraries. They need this information out in the world. And again, you cannot find this anywhere else. 30 seconds to go. Mark Torres, director of the Pacifica Radio Archives.
If we had more time, I was going to play you something that you will get on this drive, and that's Lela Downs performing live Pastures of Plenty, This Land Is Your Land, at Dolores Huerta's 80th birthday party at the Greek Theater. A beautiful song. It's included in this jump drive. Call now. Only a few seconds to go. Be that last caller.
Probably need just two more callers. Won't you be one of two? Call right now.
516-620-3602.
Ask for the very best of Pacifica Radio Archives, two USB drive set. Our phone answers are rushing to the calls right now. Hey, we want to thank Gary Bach, our engineer in Master Control. And thank you so very much, Mark Torres.
My pleasure. My pleasure.
All right, folks, stay tuned for another Fun Drive program coming your way. Don't you go anywhere.
Flying saucers, visitors from outer space, federal agents, and a time machine all meet up in the Mojave Desert at this U.S. premiere of Calling All Earthlings, a film by Jonathan Berman with original score by Elliot Sharp, whose music you are hearing right now. Calling All Earthlings explores the first UFO cults led by once Howard Hughes confidant George Von Tassel. Screenings are from August 1st to 7th at Maisel Cinema, with special events for VIP ticket holders that allow exclusive access to pre- and post-show private sound baths, lectures, and parties with filmmakers and UFO luminaries Dr. J.J. and Desiree Herzog. Maisel Cinema is located at 343 Lenox Avenue / Malcolm X Boulevard in Harlem. For more information, go to maisels.org.
And you are listening to radio station WBAI in New York. The time is just after 8 o'clock. Time for Off the Hook.
The telephone keeps ringing, so I ripped it off the wall. I cut myself while shaving, now I can't make a call. We couldn't get much worse. We'll be right back.
And a very good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Hook. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you tonight, joined by Rob T. Firefly.
Good evening.
And Kyle.
Hello. Hi.
And hopefully you, our listener. We should start by saying this is a fundraising part of the year. I think we cover pretty much every month now. It's August and we're doing fundraising, but it's essential. It's essential for the radio station to keep broadcasting. And if you've listened to this show over the past, 30 years? 1988 is the first edition of this show?
Very nearly 30 years. This October, it'll be 30 years old.
My goodness. We should do something special.
We should.
If we're not preempted for fundraising. We have been on the air for that long. And in that period of time, we've talked about a good number of things, many of which are controversial, many of which are informative, many of which are entertaining. Well, some of them are entertaining. A lot of different things. And that's only one show. So think of the power of a radio station that's able to do that 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, sometimes more. And we have existed since 1960 based solely on listener support. So that right there should be enough for you to give a call to 516-620-3602 and just pledge as much as you can afford, and you'll feel good about it.
Yeah, this is I like to think of it as a good time to remind people of the myriad of ways you can actually contribute to WBAI. We've talked about the SMS donation where you can just send WBAI, the call letters for the station, to 41444. Also, the online pledge site is give to WBAI.org. Either way, I think both are very similar and should be fairly easy. If you're asked at all, please mention Off the Hook. We do get acknowledgement for donations given during this particular show. And of course, I think the other third and last thing I'll add is the BAI Buddy program that kind of spans the different fundraisers that we've had over the last year. And I think we're still trying to increase those numbers. So if you want to just know that your contribution is done and automatically set up and is incremental and a continuing donation, that program is for you. And I encourage you also to mention Off the Hook and sign up for BAI Buddies.
Yeah, absolutely. The BAI Buddies are essential because the more BAI Buddies we can get, the more that this station actually has a predictable and dependable income level, which means we can cut down on the amount of actual pledge driving we do here at the station. So if you go to give2wbai.org or if you call 516-620-3602 and ask about the BAI Buddy program, you can choose any amount of money that you can afford to donate to what we do here that will be charged to you automatically on a monthly basis. You may have noticed if you're into supporting creative work online that so many people are doing, like Patreon and things like that, where they can just keep their work going directly through support of their fans, of their the people who follow their work. And this is no different. This is exactly the same idea in a way that BAI can make use of it. So give2wbai.org or 516-620-3602, and we encourage you to become a BAI buddy. Be one of the ongoing sources of support for the station.
If you just put it in perspective, it starts to make a whole lot of sense, because if you were to, say, become a BAI buddy and contribute $10 a month, you multiply that by 12, and that turns into $120 a year. Now, if you pledge $120 in one shot, that feels different than pledging $10 a month for 12 months. But in the end, it's the same income coming in per year for WBAI. Now, compare that to what you might spend, say, on coffee. You know, you go to a coffee shop and you could easily spend $10 a day just on a cup of coffee, you know, and multiply that by 365 and just compare the two. Does WBAI give you more than that one cup of coffee a day does? If so, well, put that in perspective and, you know, weigh the odds. A coffee shop closes, you can always go to another one. WBAI closes. Yeah, try tuning, you know, one or two notches up the dial. Tell me if that's anything like what you've heard on this radio station. I know some people will say, yeah, that's a good thing, but it depends what you listen to, obviously. People have their favorite programs. People have programs they despise. For you to have a program that you despise, it means that we are doing something that gets your brain working. All right. And sometimes arguing and opposition are healthy things. In fact, most of the time, they're healthy things.
I disagree.
Well, that just shows what you know. We'll continue this after the show, Rob. 516-620-3602. If a lot of people call, then we can have a fairly uninterrupted show where we talk about other issues that are going on. And boy, there are a lot of issues going on. We're going to talk some more about the Hope Conference, but we're also going to talk about some things that are going on in the world of technology, computers, hacking, that kind of thing. 516-620-3602. Either pledge one amount, you know, solid amount for a one-time pledge. We can accept credit cards or checks or whatever works for you, or become a BAI buddy by calling either that number or going to give to WBAI.org. You can also text 41444, as Kyle said, with the letters WBAI. That's our call sign. 516-620-3602 is the way to speak to a human, though. And there are also premiums. There are also all kinds of premiums, too many to list on the air right now, but they can tell you down in Tally Central.
They're not as important. They're thank you gifts, but they are not the the reason for giving. And, we could go into that. We have, you know why. It's our operational and other budgets. They're really built by you, and we want to be able to go back to those. So whatever it is, if it's a one-time or recurring donation like the Buddy Program, all of it counts. All of it goes towards the expenditures that you might imagine a radio station like WBAI has.
And speaking of premiums, I know people are asking, where's my premium from the previous fund drive? We have been so busy with the conference and with all kinds of other things. It's our fault. In fact, probably 90% it's our fault. There might be some others that have not been processed. We'll look into those as well, but we are going to catch up, and that'll be in the next couple of weeks. Everybody should be getting what they pledged for in the past. We are sorry about that, but we're human, and we're just so overworked.
We have records of it. We have records.
We do.
We're following up.
Yeah. All right, so getting to what's been going on in the world, this 3D gun thing, I wanted to talk about that a little bit because this is something that's been in the news all over the place. A website or a group of people are about to post blueprints for 3D printable guns, and that has been postponed. It's illegal to post blueprints for 3D printable guns online. However, hundreds of designs reportedly were downloaded before a decision was reached by a federal judge saying not to do that. What that means is if anyone posts this information online, they're in violation of federal law and can suffer very serious consequences, so it makes it unlawful to post that information and make it available to the public. Now, that issue is going to go back to court on August 10th when the sides will discuss whether a preliminary injunction is needed, and it'll be going through the courts for a while, I guess. This is something that I've been struggling with because you know how I feel about guns and gun control and all that. I think we have a sickness in this country with our obsession with weapons. Something like this, though, where you have information, something that is downloadable. How do you control that? How can you possibly restrict something that is just basically downloading? They can say it's illegal to post this, but what if somebody posted it in a different country? Then what? How do you track that without tracking everything? And that's what worries me about this. Have you guys had similar crises in your conscience about this?
Oh, I can go on and on about this story. As many people know, I've been working in the 3D printing business for many years. And
any guns when you do that?
And that's the thing is this this person behind this is really good at jumping on, or in 2012 was really good at jumping on the burgeoning story of 3D printing, this new thing that nobody was quite sure about, and using his press savviness and ability to get on this issue to make it about him. And so what happened was he already published these gun files, which are there on the internet now. It's illegal or not, it is information that was once put on the internet, so therefore it keeps circulating on the internet, and you can go get it. It's just not him putting it up right now, but it's circulating. But it does really drag certain issues to the fore, because I'm somebody who has many feelings about guns, none of them good. I might be the most anti-gun person in this room, but on other hand,
you want to fight about it? Because I think I'd give you a run for your money.
Yes, well, but we have to use swords or something. But But yeah, I am not a fan of guns. I hate them and what they do. But on the other hand, a gun is a very simple machine. It's a lever, it's a spring, it's a tube pointing in one direction. And once you legislate, once you say that a shape is illegal to have, even the virtual representation of a shape, which is a 3D file, then what? How? Where do you draw that line? Because it's a very simple device, and putting the plans to make it online, you can basically take that in all kinds of weird directions by saying like one shape is legal to have and another is not. One shape is illegal to print and another one is not. And so, looking at these as the court did before this injunction, as an issue of free speech, and saying that the file that instructs a machine on how to make a gun, or a gun-like object, is free speech. Free speech is important enough to me where I have to, like, choke back the vomit and say, okay, maybe these files should be allowed to be posted. And I think that's an idiotic thing to do, I think, for many reasons, not the least of which is if you want to build a gun, a plastic that you 3D print at home might be the worst thing to do it in. It's going to explode in your hand.
And, okay, it'll explode in your hand now, but these things are only going to get better.
That's true. That's very true. And there are the beginnings of the ability to 3D print in metal at home at the moment. So, like, it's only going to get better. It's only going to get easier to print things at home. At the moment, it's a very foolhardy thing to do, I think. But then you have to consider where this can go and where this should or shouldn't go. And so, yeah.
Yeah, I'm really torn on this because, you know, I'm thinking of challenges to this law, even though I agree with the spirit of it, or the ruling, or the desire simply to keep this out of people's hands. But, you know, if you're going to make something illegal to download, okay, then how about we read it on the radio? Is that illegal? Is it illegal to tell people how this works? You know, that's something that I come up in opposition against all the time. So it's really a tough place to be in. What I'm curious about, though, is there anything that we can think of on a current 3D printer that would be illegal for you to make right now? You know, something that, okay, I created this, and all of a sudden, as soon as you let people know, you're guilty of something, you know?
It's an interesting question. There are, there's kind of the artistic versus pornographic
Child pornography, of course. Yeah. Child pornography to the rescue again.
That has been brought up in a couple of companies I've worked for.
All right, so if you somehow create child pornography using 3D printing,
right.
I'm not quite sure how that would work, but let's say you did that, then you'd be guilty of some kind of a crime.
There have been cases where people have had things like comic books or drawings or artwork confiscated because it depicted fictional children. Is that an illegal thing to have if it's not an actual person? I don't know the answer to that, and our lawyer is off on assignment somewhere.
Well, that's 2D. That's the 2D world.
That's the 2D world.
The 3D world is different.
3D world, you could do a little sculpture or something that was the same thing. And so, like, that's something else that's questionable. But at the end of the day, it's a bunch of triangles that a computer is making in the shape of something. And, you know, it's really hurts my brain to think of where this should and shouldn't go, because even speech that I find repugnant, I have to say, well, maybe people are allowed to say it.
Interesting. Yeah, it all comes down to speech in the end. So it's a controversial issue. And honestly, I don't know how you get the genie back in the bottle after this happens. I'm hearing from right-wing people saying this is outrageous because basically you're putting guns in the hands of everybody. And I just want to say to them, that's the point we've been making for years now. Your policies have put guns in the hands of everybody. Now you see how crazy it is because it's gone one step further. So maybe you'll see how crazy it was before and we can figure out some other way to deal with the entire problem.
And speaking as someone who has been a professional and a hobbyist in the field of 3D printing for like 6-7 years now, it's been rough, describing that to somebody like a your average person. What do you do? Oh, I'm in 3D printing. Oh, that's the thing with the guns. How could you? And I have a 3D printed placard somewhere that you can download off the site Thingiverse, which is a 3D repository, and which says, no, I will not print you a blanking gun, but with an expletive where the blank is, because this is radio. And that has had to be a thing. Like, no, there's more to this. There's so much more to this than just making things that go boom. But, that's the thing that gets the press. And that's the thing that gets, the president tweeting something barely coherent at the early hours of this morning.
I think it overall just stifles innovation. I think you know, companies and even manufacturers are using this technology and should be encouraging and using it even more, you know. And I think that it is that slippery slope of, well, yeah, if we just legislate this, we start basically carving out lanes where otherwise the sort of field of innovation was wide open. And I think for rapid prototyping and making custom parts, you shouldn't impose sort of preemptive impediments to people designing different things. But I do think where they're going to have to go is, you know, if this equipment or if modified equipment is used in crimes or otherwise used after the fact, to levy higher penalties and so on, because you are adding, you know, high volume clips or whatever modifications that are they themselves already illegal insofar as the ATF is concerned and so on and so forth. So I think a lot of like sort of higher penalties and so on are going to be the most effective ways after that, and will preserve sort of the landscape of innovation, which I think is vitally like crucial. You know, I think like we're just barely familiar with 3D printing now. And the accessibility is, I think, just becoming cheap enough to like just play around with it, you know, and get familiar. I think you yourself have said, you know, you've been toying with it and working in the industry for years now. And, you know, it's only now sort of been as mainstream and popular, and it would be, I think, a shame to, start legislating what you can and cannot, do with that technology.
Yeah, and it's like under the law, you can carry a baseball bat around. It's not an illegal thing, but if you go and whomp someone over the head with it, then that becomes a deadly weapon that you've just assaulted someone with under the law. And I think the same thing applies to anything that you might print that you would then use as a weapon. It's like there's an old saying, you know, your right to swing your fist ends at my face. This is still, if you're going to go out and do something shady, sure, you probably, if you're printing yourself a gun, you probably would have found something else to use had you not had that ability. But yeah, it really recategorizes this whole thing of like banning an item when anybody can make any item.
Yeah. And I think the other caveat here is like serialization. Like, if you are a firearms manufacturer and you're using molded plastic or some other sort of additive process to create these weapons, or perhaps just to prototype and then make a mold and then injection mold or use traditional parts tooling to create a product, you're still like going to be required to sort of submit volumes, like accounting of how many products you've sold, and you're creating a model, you're serializing it. But I think an individual who's hobbying or doing this at home, who perhaps prints something, doesn't put a serialization or some sort of watermark in there, the volumes they're capable of producing and the sort of overall harm is so inconsequential compared to the overall good of allowing people to print things.
My prediction on where this will ultimately go is that a certain type of 3D printer will become the standard, and that 3D printer will work like color copiers, where if you try to make counterfeit money, it's going to somehow report you. And if you print a gun, a legitimate 3D printer will report you. And probably report you for other things as well.
But that's a really difficult thing to hope for, because the best 3D printers on the consumer level are open source right now. And that's I don't think that's just my open source bias. That's a fact that they're all pretty much based on the same guts. So anybody can build themselves a 3D printer with the right bits and pieces. And if that continues to be the case, you know, how are the people aren't going to build that sort of weird DRM into their own machines?
Yeah, I didn't say it would be an easy conversation to have. There's going to be conflict and crackdowns and all kinds of things to object to. But I think that's the solution that's going to be put in front of us, so we should be ready for that.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's like a possible outcome, possible scenario, possible way of dealing with it. But will it be desirable? I highly doubt it. And will motivated individuals with the skill be using those? Absolutely not.
All right. Well, moving on to maybe a more cheerful story. Did you hear that Charter/Spectrum is being kicked out of New York? Yeah, the State Public Service Commission voted on Friday to revoke its approval of Charter's 2016 purchase of Time Warner Cable. and ordered Charter to sell the former Time Warner cable system. I didn't know you could do this, but yeah, they apparently their service is so bad, and you know, we can all attest to that. Anyone who's ever been a customer of either Time Warner cable or Spectrum can say this. But apparently, if it gets to that level, the state can take action and actually revoke things that it approved in the past. Now, no one expects Charter to leave New York without a fight, and the company has confirmed that they plan to fight this tooth and nail. But an interesting development, too, that we also got wind of, a group of striking Charter Spectrum workers holding the picket line for nearly a year and a half have introduced a new business plan to break the corporation's stranglehold on cable TV service in New York City and replace it with a new worker cooperative that benefits everyone. Doesn't that sound great?
That would be great. It's
Pacifica. So a cable channel.
Pacifica Cable. Wow. Okay, that's an interesting concept.
Why is that so outside the realm of... We're real dreamers here.
Well, if we could pull in the kind of money that they were pulling in, our problems would be solved. I'll tell you that right now. But it took the group about 50 strikers 3 months to assemble the comprehensive business plan. So they were planning for this before all this happened, which they maintained could be enacted with limited disruption to New York City cable TV subscribers. As we said, Charter Spectrum's existing franchise agreement with the city of New York expires in 2020. So it's likely they're going to hold on to their customers until then. But after that, they have to get rid of their company and give it to somebody. A New York City Department of Information Technology and Telecommunications audit of the agreement completed earlier this year determined that because of Charter's overly broad interpretation of the term located in the city, Charter failed to engage in practices with respect to its vendor selection that demonstrate compliance with the requirements set forth in Section 17.4 of the franchise agreements, et cetera. So they're in big trouble, and they have to get out of town. And it's going to be interesting to see what takes place.
What's really fascinating about this is it's the first time in I don't know how long that a telecom monopoly basically is actually being punished for doing a crappy job and for not doing what it promised it would do. Because the whole thing behind this is that they agreed to certain terms when they got the approval to buy Time Warner. They agreed to have certain services in place and certain levels of accessibility and all that, and they've completely failed to do that. And they are actually suffering a consequence, which is not something that I think big multimedia type companies are used to, really.
Definitely.
I mean, how long has it been since divestiture?
In the consolidated sort of landscape, yeah, it's mm-hmm. indeed.
And internet service providers in this city, particularly, are monopolies, basically, because you can't really go to the other company because they've divided this place up like a Christmas turkey, and each keep their own bits and don't interfere with one another.
And they wield so much of that like lobbying power in being such a consolidated single entity in that market that mm-hmm. they can kind of kind of make deals and otherwise kind of weasel out of these things. Whereas in this case, they're actually having to face the music of not being able to work in that market.
All right. Another good news. Google is reportedly planning to relaunch its search engine in China, complete with censored results to meet the demands of the Chinese government. That's not good news. That's bad news. Oh, boy. We need to file things better in this show. Wow. The company originally shut down its Chinese search engine in 2010, citing government attempts to limit free speech on the web. But apparently that's okay now. U.S. tech giant now wants to return to the world's biggest single market for internet users because, hey, you know, we have to make money somehow, and this whole free speech thing, it's not working. So
net neutrality wasn't enough. It's not doing it for Google.
Well, according to internal documents provided to The Intercept by a whistleblower, Google has been developing a censored version of its search engine under the codename Dragonfly since the beginning of 2017. That search engine is being built as an Android mobile app and will reportedly blacklist sensitive queries and filter out all websites blocked by China's web censors, including Wikipedia and BBC News. The censorship will extend to Google's image search, spell check, and suggested search features. And, you know, if they can do it there, they can do it anywhere. And we could have censored Google here in the States and all other parts of the world as well. This is a really bad idea.
It'd be like custom, like tailored just for you and your modern lifestyle.
What, you did it for China? You won't do it for us?
Individual.
Come on, Google. You have to. You have to censor everything, right?
Bespoke censorship.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I mean, the Chinese, I'm sure, don't want to see pictures of tanks at Tiananmen Square. They just, you know, want to have a little info on the area.
Wow. This is not going to play well, I don't think. I really don't think so. Plus, there are alternatives that people can use, and they just won't use Google. But will they know? Will they know they can do that? That's the problem.
The thing is, as I understand it, from what communication I've had with people who live in China or have lived in China, it's a fairly common practice for people to just VPN when needed to access the real internet. But it's also seen as just like kind of a hassle where like, oh, well, you know, I'll just stick with what I can get, because, you know, who wants to go to the trouble? So it's a strange situation, but yeah, I mean, Google was going to do that, you know, way back when, and basically the free internet kind of gave them a bit of pushback about it. Like, Google still had, I think, Don't Be Evil in their mission statement at the time, and it was seen as kind of violating that. But, you know, it's okay now, I guess, 8 years later.
Well, and it's a substantive consumer market that mm-hmm. I think Google wants to advertise to, obviously. I mean, they can't walk away. Like, they can't deny that the spending power that they would otherwise be turning their backs on.
They like money.
Yeah, but if they lose money as a result of this from everywhere else, maybe that will knock some sense into them. If people stop using Google in places where it's not censored because they insist on doing this, you know, completely disregarding their previous statements and values, maybe, you know, they'll rethink this. I think that's really the only way to get through to them, since they've proven that's what matters to them the most. Well, the bottom line is the weapon that we have to wield.
I mean, being good at Chinese censorship is not necessarily something they're going to be proud of, or at least we'll be judging them based on this, I think.
Well, this is a story that definitely will be continuing in the years ahead. And this is something, I just saw this story, actually, which is really kind of shocking. I use that word sparingly. But wow, we've all heard of the kids being separated from their parents by ICE and the horrible things that are going on. But it's even worse than we think. Do you know that detained immigrants have to pay up to $8 a minute to talk to their kids on the phone? Yeah. A letter sent to U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement obtained by BuzzFeed News. Around 150 Democratic members of Congress argue that the practice of charging exorbitant prices to place phone calls from immigrant detention violates ICE's national standards, as if they have any of those.
That's an abuse of their contracts, because I know the phone calls are mandated. They're like, I think a part of the terms set for how the care through Department of Health Services, how that's implemented, those calls are in there. So whatever those contracts are negotiated, or rates per call, whatever that ends up being, is sort of built in per child.
They have the ability to call specific lawyers and government helplines for free. That's according to the agency's telephone access standards. But those standards also say the facilities should enable detainees to make direct or free calls to immediate family or others for detainees in personal and family emergencies, and that they should have equitable access to reasonably priced telephone services. Clearly, that definition is rather loosely applied.
Yes, it's being stretched very thinly.
So once people finally track down their kids, a lot of these detainees are paying anywhere from 25 cents to $8 a minute to talk to their children. That's according to the Texas Tribune and National Public Radio, which is, you know, a pretty steep price for cash-strapped detainees to repeatedly pay. And when they can afford to, the calls are short and sparse, usually lasting about 10 minutes. Now, as the Tribune has reported, a few major private companies dominate the telecommunications services across the country's vast web of detention and correctional facilities, greatly profiting from the influx of detained immigrants funneled into centers to await immigration proceedings. Now, we've been reporting on this for years, how, you know, we had some of our own show hosts who are detained, and we learned how much it costs to call out from prison when you're a part of that system. It's a horrible scam, and now this scam is being expanded so that detainees, people looking to immigrate into our country, are also being victimized by this. But it's so much worse. They're in a foreign country. They're trying to reach their kids. They don't know where their kids are. it must be so incredibly scary, and it's a really shameful thing.
And in many cases, this is family members who have already been deported or who were outside of the country to begin with, and so on top of what they're paying to call internationally, they're also paying the exorbitant surcharges. And yeah, there's only recently been some kind of slight pushback against the exorbitant prices of your standard prison telephone calls in this country, seeing it just strengthened all the more here. I mean, we love to talk on this program about how phone calls now are basically cheap or free, that excludes the vast population in prisons and now in ICE detention centers.
What is average prison phone call these days?
I don't know off the top of my head, but I wouldn't
we should
put
have
it too far off of this.
Why don't we have like a price check, you know, prison call? Yeah. Check, you know, around the country.
Well, I'm sure some of our listeners can tell. A lot of our listeners a good number of listeners who listen to the radio are in prison.
Oh, yeah. I know there's subscribers and listeners all over and who've probably toured several of these facilities. But we should know. We should know what the average national rate is in the U.S. But we don't.
Yeah. Well,
I'm going to say $8.
You know, all it takes is somebody writing to us from prison. And you know what? If you want to write to us from prison, you can write to us via 2600 P.O. Box 99, Middle Island, New York, 11953. Since it's unlikely you'll be able to send email to oth@2600.com, which is how a lot of people send us feedback. We would like to know. But I do know it's outrageous. It's not like what we were talking about as far as calls being free or very cheap. And I think it's a very good question for the hacker community. Why can't that be applied to prisoners? Why can't that technology be brought to them? What can we do to make that happen?
Yeah, why do they have to be punished more given just being in a certain situation in their
lives?
But
it's not them. It's their families being punished because they usually have to call collect and the families have to pay these exorbitant prices and the companies profit tremendously. This has been an issue for decades, but you know, it's an easily solvable issue where we simply get rid of the ripoffs. And because they're prisoners, we don't care. Because they're immigrants, we now don't care. And it's shameful, and it should not be ignored. All right. You might have heard the phrase inauthentic coordinated behavior. You hear that from what Facebook is being a part of recently. Deleted pages from groups who are identified by Facebook as part of this inauthentic coordinated behavior campaign, which basically targets people based on liberal politics as well as people of Hispanic and African heritage. For instance, there's a deleted post of inauthentic coordinated behavior that called for protesters to occupy the headquarters of the U.S. Department of Homeland Security's Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, posted by a group called Resistors. An event that was initially titled Stop Ripping Families Apart, D.C., was later retitled Stop Ripping Families Apart, Take Over ICE Headquarters, after Facebook users said they would attend. A total of 131 people later marked themselves as having attended the June 27th rally outside of ICE's Washington offices. But this never happened. That's what's wrong with that. And, you know, it sounds like a great idea. I'm down for it, but it's not real. It's not really happening. This is just something that exists online, inauthentic coordinated behavior. It's basically, it's Orwellian. They're rewriting the future, the present, and the past.
There's like more fake activism than actual activism. I mean, what kind of world is that?
I don't know. But, you know, we have enough real activism. We don't need the fake act. But the fake activism basically gives the real activism a bad name, or it somehow makes it less strong because you assume there's more things going on and there aren't. There's another group called Aslan Warriors. Don't know how to pronounce that. Posted an image stoking racial tension around Mexican child labor during the Great Depression, calling it a commonplace sight. This was exacerbated by racial segregation. Mexican and Mexican-American children were often not allowed in white schools, read text around the image. Though the precise identity of the groups who wrote these posts were not made public, there is evidence they were not posted by Hispanic groups or liberal activists who have been critical of ICE. Instead, they bear similarity to the Russian trolls who tried to divide voters in the 2016 election. Now, you know, the thing about this, we're very quick to blame Russian trolls. Maybe it is Russian trolls. But Russians don't have a corner on the troll market. There's trolls everywhere. Believe me, growing up on IRC, Well, actually, I was grown up and I went on ice. I regressed. Then I had to grow up again. The trolls are everywhere. They're all over the internet. They're on Twitter. They're on Facebook. They're every possible online forum you can imagine has trolls. And that is just part of the territory. You don't need to be from Russia. It probably doesn't hurt, but we would have this regardless. And any time you have an online community, this is the kind of thing you can expect. So I think once you go into it realizing that, you know, if you're not part of something face to face, it may not be true. It may not be actually happening. You have a more likely chance of getting through it without having the wool completely pulled over your eyes.
Absolutely. And the whole Facebook angle to this is especially interesting because so many people, for so many people these days, Facebook basically is what they get the internet through. It's how they message. It's how they get their news. It's how they communicate what they're doing. And it's just part of the danger of putting like one organization, one commercial organization in between you and the world and getting all your stuff through it and trusting what comes in. And, you know, I mean, all the best activist stuff that I've been part of is still using things like email lists and other like non-centralized ways of keeping everyone in touch and keeping everyone updated. And you've got to take everything with a grain of salt these days. You've got to, you know, double and triple check sources for things. And activism is no different. In fact, it's one of the main, I think, targets of this sort of thing.
Especially now when most people are thinking about these tactics, they're active, they want to have their voices heard, they want to be engaged, they want to be political or otherwise, you know, heard in this sort of frenzy of politics and social movements. That are sort of coming up and again in culture and in the news cycle, you know, it is an outlet that people are going to use and absolutely need to be heard, you know, and be able to have their they need to be invigorated, and they're looking for things to attach to or be affiliated with and feel like they're doing something that matters. And I guess when you're on that sort of heightened alert, you can also be sort of susceptible to things that aren't necessarily, they're kind of in the spirit, but they're adjacent and they're not actually as real as you might think. But that heightened alert is you're sort of, that anxiety can be exploited in some situations.
Now there's a think tank called the Atlantic Council. They've partnered with Facebook to help identify threats on the social network. They were granted access to the deleted posts that haven't been revealed publicly, they've been analyzing this whole thing. They plan to issue a longer report at a later date, they say people who run disinformation campaigns benefit whether they're discovered or not. Either they go undetected and can sow discord, or they're revealed and then people begin questioning the legitimacy of all people in a debate. And that's what appears to have happened this Monday with one organizer of a counter-protest for next month's white supremacist rally clarifying on Twitter that the entire event was not a Russian front. So it really throws chaos into everything. It's fascinating in its own way.
Yeah, I mean, if there's some activist community or activist type of thing going on, and you're either a troll or working for the other side, and you'd like to mess with it, I mean, what better way than to literally jam the radar by throwing all this sort of nonsense up into their spheres and their cycles? And it's very easy to do, and you know, lots of people fall victim to that, and it really does kind of make things just that much more difficult for the people trying to actually do things.
All right. That's pretty much what's been going on, some of what's been going on. We've got a lot of letters from our show last week talking about the recently concluded Hope Conference, some of the chaos that came out of that, some of the good things that came out of that. I'd like to read what some people have said. This is from John. I strongly support you all in this environment. We need hope more than ever. I do hope as part of your postmortem, you'll revisit the photo policy, which I couldn't find on the website, but it was in the printed program. That's interesting. Usually it's the other way around. Usually we have more on the website than in the printed program. But if I remember right, in the Off the Hook conference wrap-up back in 2016, you mentioned reconsidering the photo policy. And I was disappointed to see this year the policy had not changed. Well, interesting. And good memory, too. The policy is ineffective in stopping photography. Kyle, could you summarize what the policy is in a couple of sentences? Basically, it's very restrictive on what's allowed.
It'll be a cynical take, but basically you can't take pictures of people unless you have express permission or you give an audible warning to absolutely everyone in the photo, which that's kind of the short version.
All right. So as this writer says, the policy is ineffective in stopping photography. We all know that if someone wants a photo of any conference attendee, they could easily get it surreptitiously. The event is essentially a public space, and it's not reasonable to expect privacy outside of restrooms, private rooms, et cetera, of course. And keep in mind, there are surveillance cameras in the hotel, in almost any space you're in these days.
I think they added some. There's more.
Oh, they definitely
are. They're adding more.
They're adding more
all the time.
As we speak.
It's Manhattan.
The policy discourages documentation of the conference for historical and media purposes, art, live reporting, fun with webcams, experiments with facial recognition, etc. The policy discourages documentation of trolling / disruptive behavior. Having more photos and video of the trolling events this year would have helped clarify and document the situation. There are now open cameras live to the internet for the duration of the conference. You can say, that should be obvious to those who want to remain anonymous, but it's not. In between talks, for example, it would be quite easy in a darkened room to stand right in front of a camera and have your likeness streamed to the world live and not really know. John says he ended up on screen in the Citizen 4 movie, so I guess that does happen. In short, I believe the current policy only discourages productive sharing of photos from the event while not doing anything to discourage those who want photos for more nefarious purposes. John says, thanks as always for all of your amazing efforts on this incredible and inspiring conference. And I think there must be a hope in 2020. Otherwise, the narrative is three alt-right trolls shut down the libtard snowflake pity party. Well, I don't know if I would have said it like that, but thank you, John, for your input.
And I'm glad he set us straight.
I know, Kyle, you've got issues with the photo policy as well, and you're a photographer.
I'll let others speak. Yeah, I mean, I agree with what he said, and I can go into detail on specific things about it, but I think it's much like we were talking about the opening of the show, where you're kind of cutting off, like, one of our big things is like, okay, let's capture this great event, you know, and show our stuff. We're bad at our own trumpet, you know, trumpeting up or drumming up our own support. So part of that is taking some pictures of what you're doing and saying, hey, this is our hacker event in Manhattan. And so I think we lose out. And that's my short answer, just like with, you know, banning all parts of certain types of machines, you eliminate innovation, you eliminate the creativity and fun that can come along with that. I get people are spooked about their participation in hacker culture or however important or self-important their project is and in relation to their identity. But I think there are adequate ways to mitigate that, and that this policy combined with our conduct policy do overlap in some really unfortunate and unintended ways.
There is still a stigma attached to attending hacker events. Some people don't want to be seen in these events. It could affect them at work, could affect their social lives. But I'm wondering if that's realistic to expect that your identity won't be revealed if you're in a place with several thousand other people, and whether that causes more harm than good to keep that information, to restrict that information so that people are taking far less photographs.
Yeah, the first hacker conference I went to was Hope in 2000, and there was an individual I met there who was wearing a big hat and a bandana and the novelty Groucho Marx glasses with the big nose and mustache and eyebrows on them. When I asked this person about it, they said that it was something to do with they were on probation and not allowed to be there, but wanted to be there anyway and didn't want to be recognized. And I thought that was awesome. And this was way back when cameras were still basically film. Now, you know, there was no, you know, there were no digital cameras or, you know, a zillion free photos of whatever. But even then, I thought that was pretty inventive. I'm not saying all our attendees should maybe cosplay to the next conference, but you know, there are things you can do if you wish to alter your appearance, but still show up at a hacker conference.
Well, you know, that's an interesting approach. I'm not sure how useful it would be today if technology can get past that and identify you anyway. I'm sure Facebook is working on it.
Well, and but it speaks to the point of like the prevalence of this thing that was once, and I've said this before, was once seen as an entire device in and of itself, and now it's considered a component. Yet one other thing on the circuit board that is your phone. Mm-hmm. So like there are so many of these devices, and of course there, you know, and that I just think that should be part of your consideration of your exposure, and that one person photographing you and you know, doing something with what they have taken that you don't like is such a small and tiny bit of your overall privacy and exposure just by being at an event in Manhattan. Again, like the cameras that you should be most concerned about, you probably cannot see at all. So anyway, I think that it's just one thing that we should look at, and there are a lot of tools and a lot of other ways that people can kind of mitigate their exposure in that sense. But absolutely, cameras used to be very huge, and with the sort of the quality of them now, the resolutions and so on, we do need to have, I think, grown up or like a different perspective on our behavior with this, you know, component and this prevalent device. But at the same time, I don't think just having these like very overbearing policies and kidding ourselves in the process is very wise either.
Okay. You can join the conversation, 347-335-0818, if you have any opinions or thoughts or hope experiences. Here's another letter that we got. I was fortunate enough to attend the Circle of Hope. So first of all, thank you for an amazing event. Having grown up in Scotland, somewhat isolated from like-minded folks, it was a very interesting experience to see the culture that exists in the USA. It was many years before I could afford a modem, which was long after my computer was a C64 with a lowly data set, so I operated somewhat in isolation. I regret not taking part in the workshops, which would have been great for interacting directly with the hacking culture. I was disturbed by the reports of intimidation that were going on. Visiting the USA from the UK has always been strange, as any foreign country should be due to different cultural practices, norms, etc. I've always found the American people I've interacted with to be generally very friendly and kind. However, with the current Trump regime, there has been a change in tone. The Fox News broadcasts in the hotel were disturbing. You know, we had no control over that, right? In the elevators. That's just the way it is. Having the tone of a dictatorship's mouthpiece, Trump declares. You can also laugh at these things when you can't change them. The tone of the conference was very good. Welcomes all, set some ground rules, and expect that people are generally good to one another. It is shameful that was abused, and I hope with the discussion that follows that measures can be put in place. You have the right people to speak with. I was sorely disappointed with Steve Rambam's announcement that he wasn't going to be attending Hope in the future. My impression is that he is a good man with an allegiance to the office of the president I find utterly baffling, while it is occupied by an utterly corrupt and probably treasonous boor, spelled B-O-O-R. I would love to attend Hope in 2020 if the USA isn't split asunder by then. We'll keep you updated. I sincerely hope instead there will be some reconciliation in mainstream politics. Tone is very important, and it is set by those at the top. Signed, Stu from Cambridge, UK. P.S. The demo scene session was great. Thank you, Stu, for that awesome letter. And we invite others to write to us, too. OTH at 2600.com. Let's take a phone call. Good evening. You're on Off the Hook. Speak up, please.
Yeah, I'm here. Go ahead.
What's on your mind?
Okay, I streamed some of the talks online for Sunday talks, but Friday and Saturday I missed. Are they going to be posted anywhere?
Yes, in fact, that's something that a bunch of us have been working on for the last however long it's been since the conference ended.
Yeah, we've been negotiating with our robots, and they're basically in charge of encoding. So once the robots have completed all of their tasks, we'll be ready to share those online.
Let's be clear here. We're not talking about the people we're working with to get you the videos. We're not calling them robots. We actual physical robots that print DVDs and things like that. I just want to make sure that's clear before anybody gets insulted.
No problem. Where will I look for that? Which site? Your 2600 site or which
yeah,
site?
There'll be an announcement on 2600 and on the hope.net site.
Yeah, we have individual copies we'll make available if you want a specific talk, and then other packages.
Yeah, it'll all be on the website and hopefully within the next few weeks. Okay?
That'd be good. Thank you.
Thanks for your call. Good point. I'm glad you brought that up.
And well, one other thing we do also is provide audio for people that want to listen to things on the go, maybe catch parts of a talk that they weren't able to hear all the way through. They can fill in the gaps with audio files, which is coming soon as well.
And the streaming, again, all credit to the Internet Society, ISOC, the people there who did a fantastic job just getting it out to tens of thousands of people that weren't at the conference and were able to see every single talk. They all were streamed, all three tracks, for 3 days. It's simply incredible. I don't think any other conference in the States does that. I know CCC does that over in Germany. And that kind of was our model to try and do things the way they do it, because they get a lot of things right. And Kyle, I know you were instrumental in getting us the 10 gigabit connection to the internet, which is also something unique in this country.
Oh, I helped a little bit, but there's a great great group of network and other volunteers that that help make that happen.
That network team gets better every year. I'm blown away by their capabilities.
We aimed for some high goals, and it has basically created this massive infrastructure that we want to just make better use of and provide for attendees using for streaming, using for all kinds of promotion and other kinds of services during the event and thereafter, of course, figuring out what works and designing new things for the future.
And of course, the AV team too, with expanded space, being able to pull it off. It's just I'm actually able to be conscious and get my thoughts together, I am so blown away and in awe by what those guys are able to pull off each and every time. Just so creative, and it looks really good, and it's so incredibly professional. When you hear good sound and see clear video, it's because of the work these guys have done setting up every single stage and making it all work.
And it's uniquely American. It's got that international feel. We have speakers from all over, but we really have our own flavor, our own twist. We've taken some of what we've learned from kindred projects and events, and we've distilled it and have this wonderful group of volunteer and other coordinators that just assemble, self-organize, and build this amazing infrastructure and create a venue to talk about technology and all of these important issues to hackers. It truly is magic and really a fun thing to have been a part of.
And of course, the Hotel Pennsylvania, the perfect backdrop for all this. So much fun to be in that particular location in the city. And just the cooperation and imagination of the people there to help us have a successful event every time we do this. It's unparalleled. So hopefully we have many more of these in the future. Right now, I am drained. I'm sure everybody else is. Let's read one more letter, then we'll get out of here and make way for the next show. I was there. I was witness to the MAGA hat incident. Make America Great Again, in case those of you don't know what that acronym means. I don't think the events of fascist infiltrating groups of any kind is new, but just because a group of fascists infiltrated a group does not mean that the group is at fault or complicit in fascism. It means that the fascists are one step ahead. I think anyone with a grain of moral fiber understands this. Yes, it is frustrating that fascists gained an upper hand, but we are a creative group of hackers that can and will do something about this. We can solve this problem and many others. I refuse to use the word provocateurs for these people. Even if they are professionals and paid to do this, while not directly fascist, they are complicit in fascism. So to me, they are fascists. And by the way, I knew of the one incident, but was unaware of the others. I enjoyed the conference very much. All I can say is keep hope going. There is a lot of support for it, and many of us will help protect hope from fascists. Thank you, Bob, in Minneapolis, for that great letter.
Yeah, we have... We've gotten a lot of this kind of writing, and you know, it's something that we're going to face head on, and continue to discuss. And we're hearing all kinds of ideas, and hopefully we're going to get more and more of those coalesced into something that works for our unique community. I'm pricing shock collars now. And other forms of electrocution I'm thinking we'll make it like sort of a social thing. So wow. You upvote how many volts you get shocked with based on your behavior and how society approves of you individually.
We'll
gamify it.
We still have to have a couple of meetings to get our policies straight, but we'll keep you updated, folks, on how that goes.
It's fine. It'll
probably
be mandatory. No,
tone it down a little bit, yeah. But thank you, Kyle, for that.
Works.
Yeah, appreciate it. Rob?
Go to your local 2600 meeting. It's everywhere this Friday, 2600.com/meetings.
Yes, they take place all over the world, except in Israel, where they take place the first Thursday of the month.
And if you don't have one near you, you can start it. That same page has the info on how to do that, 2600.com/meetings.
Our email address, oth@2600.com, and we look forward to hearing from you. Have a good night.
Hey, this is Chaka Khan, and you're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM.
Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Today,
we have a brand new premium, never before offered, and only and exclusively for WBAI. And I'm very happy to be able to share this, because this is pre-going into any bookstores. It's not going to go into bookstores for at least 3 months. And there's nowhere to order it. You can't call my office. You can't go to Amazon and get it. It's only through BAI. And it's for all you people who really want something in-depth, where you want real context, where you want to learn as much as humanly possible about one topic, and that is how to live a longer life, how to reverse disease, how to prevent disease, and how to save the planet all at the same time. The new book, which is a monster book, it's over 700 pages of text alone, is called The Healthy Vegetarian, Healing Yourself, Healing Our Planet. And let me just give you an idea of some of the areas, because I decided to write a book. And let me just give you a little background. I've published over 100 books. I've sold tens of millions of copies. I've had more health bestsellers than anyone in American history. Random House, Doubleday, New American Library, all the big ones. And it used to be that you could have your editor say, oh, we'd like to do this book. And they would say, yeah, that sounds like a good idea, or no, it doesn't. Today, it's not done that way. They want little books. They want you to write like a two-page outline of what's going to be in the book and why it will sell and what's different than any other book out there. And then a whole committee decides on it. And if anyone on the committee doesn't like it, you don't get your book published. Well, that's not how I work. In fact, when they said that no one will read another feminist book because there have been 1,000 and they're not selling now, and so I said, but I want to write a book that is different. And they said, how's it different? So I went through why it was different, and I turned in a 1,636-page book. They published it, and it sold 75,000 copies in hardback, and it's a perennial bestseller in that field. I co-wrote it with Barbara Seaman, one of the most important feminists in American history. So when they say write a 180-page book, 200 pages is a big book today, I do just the opposite. I speak, how can you tell everything that needs to be told in such a short amount of space? You shouldn't crimp yourself. I said, but today people want everything very short, everything very succinct. Tell me the full work of Shakespeare, all of his work in the next 10 minutes. Just give me a synopsis. Well, no one can do that. So when it comes to our health, how are you supposed to know everything you need to do in a 100-page book or 200-page book? You can't. It means you're going to have to cut the heart out of everything. You're only going to get superficiality. In this book, I told the publisher I will only do it if I'm not limited. If I feel there's something that people need to know, I want to be able to state it and show them and use essay form. And they said, fine. So The Healthy Vegetarian, Healing Yourself, Healing the Planet is just that book. So first I start off in the first chapter. I'm just going to give you some ideas of chapters of where do you begin. No two of us begin in the same place. If you're an 18-year-old who's just decided that maybe you should start changing your diet and your health habits, or if you're 70 and you've got all kinds of disease, you're both starting at a different place. So how do you give information where everybody benefits? Because there are certain things everybody has to do no matter what your circumstances or background. Get rid of what's harmful. Then I have a whole chapter on getting rid of what's harmful. A lot of people don't know everything is harmful. And also, what's so bad about inflammation? On my show today at noon, I talked about inflammation and that it's a major, major destroyer. And so how do you turn off all inflammation in your body? So that means you will be helped if you have arthritis, bursitis, ileitis, colitis, spastic colon, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, heart disease, cancers, glaucoma, macular degeneration. All of those are helped when you can turn off inflammation. So that is a biggie. And that also means you're more likely to have depression and anxiety in your brain aging if you have inflammation in the brain. So turning off inflammation in the body, right up in that first chapter. The dangers of processed foods. America's need to supersize. What can we eat then? And so rather than focus upon the negative, I show people here's what you should eat, can eat, and must eat. But it's very specific because stream beans do not give you the same power as green soybeans. Completely different. And a cruciferous vegetable like a radish or kale or watercress, parsley, asparagus, asparagus, those are different than if you were to have, let's say, some normal vegetables that people eat that are okay, but they're not superstars. So what are the superstars? What should I have each day that will really help my body? And then the dangers lurking in processed foods, what we don't know about, like the artificial sweeteners. Then the importance of an alkaline diet. I get this question all the time. Gary, I heard you say that you should take a teaspoon of lemon juice in the morning and a teaspoon of apple cider vinegar. Why? So I explain how your body functions when it's acidic, when you drink coffee or have meat, and when it's alkaline. So the importance of an alkaline diet, and the which foods are alkaline, and there's a grading of it. So if you want really alkaline foods, some ones that can really help you turn off pain and help the body heal, give you more energy, you can now see, oh, if I drink that grapefruit juice and have some lemon in it, if I eat these particular foods, my body is going to be more alkaline. That's what I want. And then also the whole idea of going to a plant-based diet. What is it? How do you make it work? What are the problems you're going to face? How do you eat healthy when you're eating out with people that you're around? You go to a restaurant. And to give you an idea of this, I asked people in the health support groups that I've done for almost 45 years, over 30,000 people. I asked them, it's not what you learn in this class today. It's what you do when you go home and you're faced with the reality of being at home where it's not a classroom, it's not a retreat. You got to show that you're going to say no to the things that you're going to fall back on that are bad. Let me give you an example of this. I had a man show up uninvited, wasn't on the list, with major gangrene. In fact, the day before, he had been in a California hospital preparing for surgery to take off his left leg. And he just decided on a whim later in the day, he didn't want to have that happen. He had massive ulcerated sore, and so he went back home. He wrapped his whole leg in bandages and in plastic bags to keep the smell down because it smells like death. He got on a plane, flew to me, and a friend walked inside and said, Gary, someone's outside, and they stink. I walked out, and I immediately knew it was gangrene. And we had some physicians and nurses there and said, pull up your pant. And he did, and here was this massive oozing sore. Over the next 3 weeks, by changing the diet, being very alkalizing, juicing, it completely healed 100%. In fact, some of the guests at that retreat were taking photographs each day, and he left, he was completely healed. And I said, now remember, if you go back home and you go off the diet, it's going to come back. Well, he went home. I didn't hear from him for a year. He came back a year later. It was back. I said, what happened? Well, you know, you're at a party, and you know, one drink's not going to hurt, and a hamburger's not going to hurt, and french fries not going to hurt. You know, and I socialize a lot, and I'm a single guy. And he's a former basketball player. He's like 6'10". And he said, so I'm out there socializing, and then my immune system collapsed, and then the infection came back. Well, I helped him heal again. Gone. I said, this is it, buddy. You're on your own. Now, the message here is that there's lots of good advice out there. There are a lot of physicians, holistic nurses, dietitians, nutritionists, lifestyle counselors who can give you insights that can help you. But if you think that the only time you have to be healthy is when you're in their presence, that's the problem. You have to make this an everyday choice. And that requires some discipline and getting out of addictive behavior. So that's this whole part here about who controls your health choices and getting into sustaining healthy eating and drinking. And then I go into the history of the food industry and follow the money trail and GMOs and who controls your food choices and the basic four food group, why it's a myth, and the high cost of meat and dairy, and what's wrong with meat and dairy, and king cattle, deceptive dairy, you should never eat dairy, and why, and then the social norms, why you cannot follow social norms are almost always based upon people doing the wrong thing because they've been propagandized. And then what role does the mass media play in it? Let's be realistic. If you run a television station or a radio station or a newspaper and the ads come in and your whole ability to pay salaries and keep yourself solvent is by, you know, putting these ads on the air, what's the likelihood that you're going to do a show that's going to contradict all of your advertising?
Uh-huh.
The advertisers are not going to tolerate that. So I show you why we don't get the true nature of how to eat in the right way. I have a whole section on food and culture, because when I travel around the world, I always look at the different cultures and the foods that they present and how they use foods, not just as a way of